Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable, but the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Over the last decade, there's been an increase in the number of people, particularly young adults, who struggle with low moods, distractibility, and anxiety, and consequent difficulties with getting their life on track and making progress in work, friendship, and romance. In addressing these difficulties, people are often given or adopt a mental health diagnosis and look for a solution in therapy and/or medication. My guest isn't opposed to these remedies. She is herself a clinical psychologist who's maintained a practice for a quarter century that specializes in treating clients in their 20s. But Dr. Meg Jay, who's also the author of The 20-Something Treatment, believes that a lot of what young adults, and in fact adults of all ages, struggle with aren't disorders that need to be treated, but problems that can be solved. In the first half of our conversation, Meg explains what's behind the decline in mental health for young adults and how it's bigger than just smartphones. We discuss the dangers of self-diagnosis, the potential downsides of using medications to treat mental health issues, and why she advocates for skills over pills. In the second half of our conversation, we talk about how mental health gets better when we get better at life, and what skills 20-somethings and many older adults need to develop, including the skills of thinking, feeling, working, socializing, and even cooking. We also discuss how porn is affecting the young men in her practice, an alternative to being a self-assurance junkie. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/MegJ. All right, Meg Jay, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's so great to be here, Brett.
So I was looking, the last time we talked to you was 2013. You're one of our first podcast guests. You're in episode number 51.
Oh, I love it. Well, I said, I feel like we're old friends. I've always had a special place in my heart for the art of manliness.
Well, thank you so much. We talked about your book the last time, The Defining Decade. It's about your 20s. And that book actually inspired a few articles that we wrote on the site. And it really resonated with me at the time because I was in my 20s when I first came across that book.
Nice.
And you got a new book out. It's called The 20-Something Treatment, A Revolutionary Remedy for an Uncertain Age. So background on you, you are a clinical psychologist who specializes in working with 20-somethings, young people.
Yep.
And one thing we've been seeing in the zeitgeist a lot recently in blog post articles, news articles, et cetera, is that young people today, we're talking teens, people in their 20s, are in the midst of a mental health crisis. What do the statistics say about the mental health of young people today? And what are you seeing with the patients you are encountering?
Yeah, well, I've been specializing in 20-somethings for 25 years, believe it or not. And you might remember from your 20s, it's a tough time. So I think people hear, oh, these are going to be the best years of your life. Really, I'm sorry to say, they're actually, empirically speaking, a mental health low point. That has been the case for a while. I think now, I mean, that's why I've always been working in the space. I think people are talking about it more now, which is potentially a good thing, but I think part of the conversation about young adult mental health too quickly becomes, what's my diagnosis? What's the medication that I need? So a lot of what I do is really normalize a lot of the problems that 20-somethings and adults of all ages have and talk about strategies for looking at those that aren't just necessarily therapy or medication.
So yeah, we're seeing a lot of young people and a lot of people, just even older people, talking about anxiety, depression, ADHD, things like that. When psychologists try to explain like what's behind this uptick in mental health, what are the reasons they give?
I think what you hear people saying a lot is phones and the pandemic, and those certainly played a role. I think what I see a lot with young adults and adults of all ages, but, you know, everything that I see is just sort of more acute with young adults, is just how uncertain 21st century life is. The brain really doesn't like uncertainty. So in your 20s, everything is uncertain all at the same time. You're uncertain about work and love and friends and where you're going to live and who you're going to be. And that's a lot. The brain doesn't like that. And it tends to respond to uncertainty by perceiving it as danger and then therefore feeling stressed and anxious. But that doesn't mean that you have an anxiety disorder. It means you're feeling anxious. There's a lot in your life that's uncertain. So let's help you sort of pin some things down and feel more sure of yourself.
Yeah, you call uncertainty a transdiagnostic stressor.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a mouthful of a word and maybe a boring label. But, you know, in the research, that's what uncertainty is known as. And what that means is that it's a stressor that shows up differently in different people. So when people are feeling overwhelmed by uncertainty, some people get anxious, some people feel hopeless and lay in their bed and feel depressed. Other people reach for substances, other people eat too much or eat too little. So it's definitely a stressor for most human beings, and how it manifests depends on the individual.
Yeah, I can see that in my own life. Uncertainty causes so much stress. When I remember when I was in my 20s, one stressor that I had that was caused by uncertainty was when I was in law school and I took my final exam, because your whole grade depended on one exam
right.
for the semester.
No stress,
and
right?
No stress. So you took the test and then after you're done, you do these postmortems in your head because you didn't know how you did.
Right.
And then you'd go down this spiral where you're just like, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, I probably... Basically, it all led to like, we're going to end up, tell my wife, like, we're going to end up homeless.
Of course. And
bankrupt.
That's such a great example of really the big picture of the 20s is that people don't like it. Probably took you a week or two to find out the results of that exam. Yeah. But in your 20s, in terms of what am I going to be? Is my life going to work out? Will I be happy? Will anyone love me? Will I be successful? Can I pay my bills? Those are things that remain uncertain for a good 5 to 10 years of time. And so that's a lot to cope with. And it does tend to make people feel anxious and stressed until they have those data points that give the feedback that, okay, you're going to work this out. This is moving in the right direction. But the brain just doesn't like that.
Yeah. And this uncertainty that causes things like anxiety or feeling depressed and just down, this can happen, you know, later on in life when you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, when you have those moments of uncertainty in your life. Maybe you get laid off from your job and you think, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to my family? Or maybe there's something with your kids you're worried about. Same sort of thing can happen to you.
Yes. I mean, I had a health issue last year and I was really feeling for my 20 somethings because suddenly there was this new piece of uncertainty in my life. And, you know, at this point in my life, my career is pretty sorted and my love life is sorted and I have kids and I know where I'm going to live. So there's not a ton of uncertainty in my life anymore. But I had this health issue come up and suddenly there was all this uncertainty and it was really difficult until I got some information of, okay, this is the deal and this is what we do. And then I noticed how, you know, sort of like with your law school exam, suddenly I was like, great, I know what to do now and I know what this means. So you're going to have those periods again and again throughout life, whether it's health or changes in work or changes in your relationship. We usually get better at handling them over time because we have more experience of, okay, I've been here before, I've gotten through this, I'll find a way. You feel like you can count on yourself. The hard part about being in your 20s is you don't feel like you can count on yourself yet, and you don't have a lot of data points for how this works.
And I can see this idea of uncertainty causing all this distress. I can see why the pandemic would exacerbate that. Right? She was like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? I don't know if I'm going to have a job. Is this ever going to end? And I can also see how smartphones can exacerbate that, because you're just constantly plugged into this thing that's showing you all sorts of different information. You're not exactly sure, like, what should I act on? What's the good stuff? And that can probably just cause even more uncertainty.
Right. And it's, you know, we've all heard by now the social comparisons, you know, that phones induce. You know, we're always looking at people on vacation or skydiving in Dubai. I mean, they're having amazing time and amazing lives and amazing relationships. And so it's hard when you feel like, I don't really know if my life is going to work out. But look at all these other people's lives who are working out beautifully. Your brain knows that this is not a fair fight in terms of the data being presented, but it still has to go through that process of, ugh, you can't believe everything you see. And, you know, maybe I'm not doing as badly as I think. And, you know, that's a lot. So I think, you know, people of all ages have to decide what platforms they're going to use, what makes them feel happy, what makes them feel unhappy, or how they use them and how much they use them.
Okay. So uncertainty, we don't like uncertainty. It can cause us to get anxious, feel just low and depressed. It can even cause us or nudge us towards using substances to alleviate some of the bad feelings we have when we're facing uncertainty. We experience a lot of uncertainty in our 20s because we're figuring life out, but that people in their 30s, 40s, 50s can also experience this. And one way people have tried to cope with the feelings of angst that come with uncertainty is they turn to psychology. Which makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. Psychology is there to help you deal with those sort of things. But you note in your book that there's been a trend of young people, and I've seen this not just with young people, but even people my age in their late 30s, 40s, people self-diagnosing themselves with mental health disorders. What are the dangers of self-diagnosing?
Yeah. I mean, I think when we're feeling uncertain, we're you know, casting about for, give me something I can act on. I mean, it was, you know, a bit like what I was talking about with my health issue last year, of, you know, let me understand what this is and what we do. So I think it's very tempting to say, what's wrong with me? What's my diagnosis? What's the 3-point plan? Although, you know, most mental health problems don't have a 3-point plan. Or what's the medication required? And, you know, the truth of the matter is most young adults, most adults of all ages don't have diagnoses. They have problems they're trying to solve. They have changes they need to make. They have skills they need to build. And I think one of the drawbacks of looking for certainty in a diagnosis is that, you know, your identity can become pretty wrapped up in that. And then you see everything through that lens rather than through the lens of, hey, I'm in a transition, or this is a tough time, and what are the skills I need to build? What are the changes I need to make? Rather than looking for, you know, what's the medication I need to take?
Yeah, you talk about, you know, giving yourself a diagnosis can cause a nocebo effect in you. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, the nocebo effect is the opposite of the placebo effect, which of course is if you think you're going to get better, you're more likely to get better. The nocebo effect is really the power of negative expectations. So I have a lot of people come in my office and they say, I have this and I'm going to have this all my life. And I've read this is a lifelong problem, and they see everything through that lens. And so it can get in the way of people actually getting better or having hope that, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not doing something wrong. I'm just having a hard time. So what is it I need to do to move forward? And people who have hope are more likely to take action to, you know, kind of move their lives ahead. They're less likely to feel anxious and depressed, less likely to think about ending their lives. So I think sometimes people look for certainty in diagnoses, and which they may not really have. And believe it or not, that can actually get in the way of finding hope that life could be better 6 months or a year from now.
Yeah, because you take on that, like you said, you take on that identity. Like, I'm depressed. I'm a depressed person. I'm always going to be depressed. And yeah, you might, like you said, you might be feeling low because you're going through a hard time in college, or you just had a breakup, a lot of uncertainty. So, you know, if you open up the DMS-5, you know, the diagnostic tool, and you look at the symptoms for depression and you say, well, I got that. Now, like, yeah, you just kind of look at everything as like, well, I'm depressed. There's nothing I can do about it.
Right. Or great. Now on top of, you know, being laid off, now I'm also depressed, rather than saying after loss, whether it's loss of a job, loss of a relationship, loss of, you know, anything, it's normal to feel sad and depressed. It doesn't mean you have a disorder. I mean, that's grieving. And so it helps often to say this is a normal reaction to a loss in your life. And what does that tell you about what it is that you value, that you want to get back in your life? Meaningful work, close connections, you know, what did you lose that you want to get back, rather than let's just alleviate the symptoms?
How has social media exacerbated the problems of self-diagnosing?
Well, you know, when I first started doing this 25 years ago, for better or for worse, the DSM, the kind of psychiatrist Bible you were talking about a minute ago, that was only available, or, you know, no one would go out and purchase that. It was a $100 doorstop of a book and extremely boring and dry. So no one really had access to what are these mental health disorders and how do you diagnose them? And now, you know, for a lot of reasons that are good, that information is widely available on the internet or in on social media in quick little tidbits and quick videos. And it's actually what we used to call medical student syndrome, that people would go into medical school and they would read about illnesses and disorders and decide they had all of them because, you know, they could see themselves in so many. So something similar happens on social media. People hear about anxious attachment style and they decide they have it, or, you know, panic disorder and they decide they have it, or bipolar disorder or borderline personality disorder, which is very rare, but people decide they have it. And so then, you know, it's sort of a misunderstanding of what's going on. They're locating the problem in their brain rather than in their everyday life.
Yeah, you say about the social media mental health stuff that goes on TikTok and Instagram Reels or whatever. There's a fine line between social awareness and social contagion.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's cool that people are becoming more aware of, hey, you know, the 20s or many points in adulthood are difficult and people have these struggles and this is very normal. But it's not so great when everybody decides that, oh, you know, I have this disorder. Or we've even seen how, quote unquote, disorders can literally spread on social media. There was a lot of research done around during the pandemic around these tics, like, you know, that people were developing in terms of, you know, squinting or saying words over and over again, that young adults or teenagers would see these videos of people saying, I can't stop doing this. And then they started doing it. And so there was this unprecedented number of people going into neurology clinics with tics that were specifically the ones that were circulating on TikTok. So that was a very concrete example, but I see the same thing with right now. I can't tell you the number of people who keep coming in and telling me they have anxious attachment style, and they don't. They're just feeling, you know, uncertain about, gosh, I don't know if this person likes me, or I'm not sure who my friends are. And that's a pretty normal way to feel in your 20s. It doesn't mean that you have anxious attachment style.
Yeah, I've seen, you know, I get this like mental health stuff that pops up in my Instagram feed. And when I look at this, because I've talked to enough psychologists and I've read enough books about this because of the podcast, I can look at some of the stuff like, this is not legit. Like, this is just some person who maybe had some problems and now they're trying to like help other people, whatever. One thing I've seen is like this idea that procrastination is a trauma response. Mm. And I'm like, but probably not. You're probably just, you know, you're like anybody who procrastinates. It's just, you don't like doing the thing. It's not pleasant to do. So you're putting it off.
Right. And I think, you know, I actually haven't even seen that, Brett. So I'm curious of A, what's the connection, and B, how is that helping people to say, oh, great, not only do I procrastinate, but I'm also traumatized. So I'm not sure what's going on there. But yes, I see procrastination in my office all the time. And I think sometimes people panic and say, oh, no, that means I have ADHD, or that means I have, you know, fill in the blank. And often, like you're saying, it's young adults and adults of all ages trying to grapple with the reality that they have to do things they don't want to do. And the brain would like to avoid that as long as possible. But eventually, hopefully, we learn through experience, much of it painful, that it's actually just easier to not procrastinate, to do stuff in small bits, starting sooner rather than later, that this is part of, you know, growth and development.
Okay, so instead of being quick to take on a mental health diagnosis, if you're feeling anxiety, just feeling depressed, maybe scattered brain, et cetera, you try to help people figure out that come to you. you know, whether those feelings they're having can be attributed to some situational stressor. Mm-hmm. Like maybe you're not depressed. Maybe, you know, you're feeling low because you got a bad grade this semester in college, or maybe you lost your job, or maybe you're having some problems in your relationship. Mm-hmm. How do you, I mean, one thing I've noticed when it comes to mental health, people can get really touchy about questioning diagnostic labels they've given themselves because it's like tied up with their identity. Mm-hmm. So how do you do this as a practitioner? Help them maybe look at things differently and kind of nudge them to look at maybe the feelings or problems they're having can be attributed to a situational thing and not to a disorder.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it may be because I do this day in and day out. So I usually just very, you know, matter-of-factly with a smile say, well, I'm not so sure this is a disorder. Maybe this is something going on in your day-to-day. So let's talk about your day-to-day. And I usually ask people to tell me a lot of detail about their work and love and life and health and sleeping and substances and porn and everything. I get real familiar with the details of people's lives. And then I start to maybe help them connect the dots between what's going on day to day and how they're feeling. And then, you know, obviously only can go off of what clients tell me, but you'd be amazed. Most people tell you what their problem is, even if they don't realize they're telling you that. They tell you, you know, where the gaps are, where things are going sideways. And then they're, you know, end up basically suggesting their own solutions. And so you say, well, why don't we start there? Why don't we start by addressing this issue or having this or that conversation or changing who you live with or talking to your boss at work? And then just sort of work on it on the ground through a life intervention rather than through a medical intervention.
And you make clear in the book, you're not against mental health diagnoses, but you're only going to provide one if you think it's going to be useful for the person.
Yeah. Yep.
You're going to try these, you know, life interventions first.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always thinking with a client, do I need to diagnose this person in order to help them? Because oftentimes, what difference does it make? You know, what you do or don't call it. The question is, what do you do about it is really the important thing. So, you know, I'm thinking, do I need to diagnose this person in order to help them? How could a diagnosis help them understand what's going on? Or how could a diagnosis limit their understanding of what's going on? And I mean, you know, these are not black and white issues. I mean, I've been doing this 20 years, so there's some finesse involved in trying to decide when is a diagnosis helpful, when might it be limiting. And I'm also not for or against medication. I'm just for people understanding that medication has upsides and it has downsides. And I like for people to be educated about what those are when they make decisions about whether to start or continue or to stop a medication for a mental health problem.
Well, let's talk about mental health medication, because that's another thing you're seeing an uptick in, people turning to psychoactive medication to relieve feelings of sadness, angst, feeling scattered brain. Do we know how many people are taking psychoactive medication today?
Yeah, about 1 in 5 are taking a mental health medication. And actually, among adults of all ages, antidepressants, this is a kind of a shocker of a data point, are the most likely prescription medication to be in your medicine cabinet from the age of, you know, 20 to 60. If you've got a medication in your medicine cabinet from age 20 to 60, it's most likely to be an antidepressant. So they're quite widespread. They have upsides and they have downsides. And I think about 80% of prescriptions for mental health meds are made by general practitioners. And I don't have anything against general practitioners either, but they don't specialize in these medications. They don't specialize in young adults. And often because of, you know, no fault of their own, they're limited to 15-minute appointments. And so oftentimes young adults and adults of all ages are given medications after very brief conversations where you're not able to get a lot of context of, hey, what's going on in your life? Is there something we might want to work on there before we give you medications that do have side effects?
What does the research say about the efficacy of these drugs, like the upsides and the downsides of it?
Yeah. So antidepressants are not a silver bullet. They're estimated to work about 50% of the times. And by work, I mean the effects that people appreciate. So the upsides of them is they can make people feel less sad. They make kind of the lows less low and the anxiety less intense. So that's why people take them. I think what many people don't realize is that they don't just work on one end of the emotional spectrum, that they basically kind of turn down the volume on emotions in general. So they make the lows less low, but they make the highs less high. So you'll hear people say, yeah, I'm less depressed and anxious than I used to be, but I don't really enjoy my life much. I'm also not that happy. Don't have a lot of motivation. They can really cause a lot of sexual side effects. So people just aren't that interested in sex or don't feel like they could get much pleasure out of it. And they can also cause some weight gain, which is, you know, a big issue, especially for young adults while they're trying to kind of start their life and have relationships. So most young adults don't know about the negative side effects when they go on the medications. And often there isn't a plan for, well, how long am I going to be on this? So most people go on mental health medications thinking like, you know, maybe I'll do this 6 months to a year. Whereas in the end, the majority of people end up staying on these medications for 5 to 10 years.
Okay. So antidepressants work 50% of the time, like it's 50-50 chance that it could work.
Yeah, it's not, they're not a silver bullet. They're absolutely not. You know, some people find that they are somewhat helpful, and just as many people find that the side effects really outweigh the positive effects. So, you know, I think people have heard or imagine there's this kind of like, well, why not? We know it'll work. We know it'll help. There's no downsides, but none of what I just said is the case. So we don't know they're going to be that helpful, and there are downsides.
Yeah, we had a podcast guest a few weeks ago who said that antidepressants don't work much better than a placebo. And I got a couple comments from some listeners who said something like, hey, you shouldn't have let him say that. You know, that was misinformation. But that's what the evidence shows. I mean, you can Google, are antidepressants more effective than a placebo? And you'll find articles on it. And in a recent study, this was a reanalysis of a meta-analysis on the effectiveness of antidepressants. And I'm going to link to it in the show notes. This study concluded, it is unclear whether antidepressants are more efficacious than placebo. And as you said, it works for some people. What I've read, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that antidepressants, they particularly work well for people who have severe depression, like they can't even get out of bed depression. And then right. You take the antidepressant, they'll hopefully get you going so you start doing the things like exercising, socializing, doing those things that'll help you start, you know, alleviating your depressive symptoms.
Right. Yes. I mean, I think at this point, physicians who really know what they're doing, that is the suggestion. However, I mean, I see all the time that the first hint of, I feel anxious, I feel depressed, physicians saying, well, try this, why not? I mean, that is the medical model. If you diagnose something and you give someone medication, I mean, it is not their model to say, let's talk about lifestyle interventions or what's happening in your relationship or what's going on at work. That is not what they're trained to do. That is not what they have time to do in 15 minutes. But I am not a anti-medication person, and it's not misinformation. The data is there that if you look at all the studies that have been done on antidepressants, they work about half the time, and it's very unclear who they're going to help and who they're not going to help. So they're really not a silver bullet. So I think at this point, people who are careful and really know what they're doing, they reserve them for those at whom you feel like we've got to really try everything. For me, I mean, I'm a psychologist, so prescribing meds is not my lane in the first place, but I'm looking at what else, you know, I'm looking at skills over pills. What are the skills this person needs? What are the experiences they need to be having, the changes they need to make? Because oftentimes there's plenty to work with there, and those sorts of interventions have no negative side effects.
Okay, so there's downsides to things like antidepressants. You also talk about other drugs, benzos for anti-anxiety, but those are extremely addictive. And you said, yeah, the group most likely to wind up in a hospital emergency department, young adults, because they took too many benzos. Another one I've been reading about is stimulants, like Ritalin and Adderall for ADHD. I guess there's like a shortage in the country because everyone wants these things. What's going on there?
I mean, there's no question. I have worked with so many ADHD folks over the years in college, young adulthood, very difficult time for people with ADHD. And there's no question, if you have a real diagnosis of ADHD, stimulant medication will help you. And I'm the first person to say, let's do skills plus pills in this situation for students, especially with ADHD. College is very difficult to get through without stimulant medication if you're neurodivergent. However, there's some really interesting research just very recently about when you're a neurotypical person and you take stimulants, they found that people will work harder and longer. So there is that feeling of, oh, if I take stimulants, I can pull an all-nighter, I can study more, I can, you know, really lean into my paper or my test more. You will study or work longer and harder, but the quality will be lower. It's like going to the SAT, you know, jacked up on too much caffeine if you don't usually drink caffeine. It's just, it's not actually what the neurotypical brain needs. So, you know, this article is talking about how smart drugs aren't that smart for people who have neurotypical brains. It's not what your brain needs. And so you're not probably going to get the results you're going for.
Okay, so medications, not always the best medicine. They can be useful in certain circumstances, but you'd be working with a trained practitioner with this. And again, you talk about how social media has exacerbated the problem of people relying on medications to treat these, you know, underlying mental health disorders because of uncertainty. Not even disorders, just feeling not great, you know?
Yep.
Because with I don't know what my Instagram feed thinks about me, the algorithm thinks about me, but I get these ads for like ADHD medication, and like you just got to have like a 15-minute consult online, and then in a few days you get and pick up a prescription at Walgreens.
Yeah, it's a big problem. You know, we talk about social media as not being great for mental health in terms of, you know, all the comparisons and looking at other people's lives, but not enough is said about how much it's really funneling people into diagnoses and medications where, you know, they're really not getting the best information about whether that's really the right treatment for them.
Okay, so instead of spending time diagnosing themselves or looking for a doctor to give them a prescription or even spending lots of time in therapy, you mentioned this phrase earlier, you recommend skills before pills, and you argue that people who are feeling distressed might be better served in developing skills. Why is that?
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I specialize in young adults. So, you know, they still have a lot to learn. A lot is new. People are in their first jobs, first relationships, first apartments, first, you know, conflict resolution. So there's a lot that 20-somethings don't yet know how to do. And that's okay. This is not a judgment. This is just developmentally normal. So when you ask people what's going on in your life, they often can point to areas where they're struggling, areas where they're not feeling confident or competent, or where they're not sort of feeling able to gain ground. And usually if you take on those areas, then people start to feel better without medications. That, you know, you ask people about the ins and outs of their lives and what does a day look like? What does a week look like? What's going on? And you can see that there are areas for growth.
Okay. So when you develop skills, you're able to reduce the uncertainty in your life. You're like, well, I know how to handle this because I know how to make a decision. I know what I need to do to fix the problem that I encounter at school or my relationship.
Yeah, that it's, you know, I say a lot to my clients, mental health gets better when life gets better. And, you know, also when we get better at life. And so, you know, I try to work with people to help them improve their situation and or improve how they're handling their situation. That, you know, if there's a lot of uncertainty out in the world that you can't change, one thing you can change is feeling more sure of yourself, of saying, well, I can count on myself, that I know I can get through this or find another job or have a better relationship next time or handle this distressing situation, that you start to feel just more sure and more certain of yourself. And that's a normal thing to be developing in your 20s. I mean, I would say by the time you're where you are in life, Brett, you probably feel like you can't control everything that happens in the world, but you probably feel pretty confident that you'll manage, you'll figure it out, you can handle it.
Right.
And that is amazing. And that's not the way 20-somethings feel. So they feel like they can't control anything out in the world and they have very little confidence that they can handle anything from, I don't know how to ask my boss for, you know, time off to go to a wedding to, I don't know how to find love or make friends. I mean, there's just a lot they're learning. They're on a very steep learning curve.
Is this, you know, this idea, this confidence, is this identity capital? You've written a lot about identity capital.
That certainly helps. So in my previous book, In the Defining Decade, I talked about identity capital as, you know, a lot of 20-somethings talk about they're having an identity crisis. They need to figure out who they are and who they're going to be and, you know, what life is going to be like. And you really can't, forecast that. But one thing you can do in your 20s is get out there and have experiences, you know, especially at work is the leading driver of positive personality change in the 20s, because, you know, there's so much skill building that goes on at work. And so a lot of those skills that we gain, not just at work, but also in experiences, life, hobbies, et cetera, is what's called identity capital. And it's just this feeling of, okay, I know how to do things. I feel confident. I feel competent. You know, my job can go sideways, but I'll find another one, or this relationship may not work out, but you know, there are other people in the world that might love me. It's that sense of that I know how to do things.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. There are millions of workers, but there's only one you, with only one body. So why wear it down with lesser power tools? You deserve ease. You deserve safety. You deserve Bosch. With Bosch tools, you can raise the X-Lock, hammer drill, or 2-in-1 with pride and know that you deserve it. Now lower it. Safety first. Bosch tools, what hard workers deserve. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. And with a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million bucks, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to, you know, set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. There have been a lot of amazing people as guests on this podcast, but what if you want to go deeper? If you're looking somewhere to learn from the most remarkable people, that's Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 200 classes to pick from, with new classes added every month, and they have over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AON podcast guests. For example, Chris Voss has a class on negotiation, Jocko Willink has a class on leadership, and Malcolm Gladwell has a class on writing. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. One class that I've really enjoyed is the one with Chris Voss on negotiation. My favorite lesson in that class was the lesson on tactical empathy, something we talked about in the podcast that we did with him a long time ago, but he goes in deeper with this. And besides just the lectures, you get exercises so you can actually put this stuff into practice. Right now, listeners will get an additional 15% off annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. And now back to the show. Okay, so in your book, you talk about various skills that 20-somethings need to develop. But as I was reading it, I thought, man, these are skills all people need to keep working on even as they
get
older.
Absolutely.
And the first skill is how to think. How do people mess up their thinking?
Yeah. So, you know, people may hear that and think, well, I know how to think. I think all the time. But, you know, if you really dig into it, thinking is complicated, that when we're in an uncertain situation, the brain is wired to think negatively. So, you know, your brain is wired to keep you alive, not happy. So if it's not sure what to think about a job interview or a, like you said, the law school exam you took or a first date that you're going on, it's going to assume the worst. And that's kind of the better safe than sorry approach to life, which we really can't stop our brains from doing. It's evolutionarily programmed to do so, to keep us alive. But what you have to do after that is to say, okay, I see how my brain just did that. Those are my fears. Those are my what ifs, but can I spend some time thinking about some facts, some what is? So what do I actually know about this situation? Have I ever been in a situation like this before? What happened last time? You know, what if this difficult thing came to pass, what would I do about it? How could I solve that problem? So it's really helping our brains not just get stuck on the catastrophic what ifs, which is the first place they're going to go, but to say, I'm going to force my brain to spend some time also thinking about what is happening in this situation, or what else might be happening besides the worst case scenario. But that takes work. Your brain is not going to want to do that naturally. The older you get, the more data points and experience you have, the more your brain will feel like, yes, I can think more flexibly about this situation. But when people are younger, it's very difficult. They have a lot of negative thoughts and feelings.
Yeah. And you gave a lot of examples of patients you've worked with. You change the names, or maybe these are an amalgamation of different people. But what you do is when they come in with the problem, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm depressed and here's this thing. And then you just, what you do is you just walk them through. It's like, well, let's find out the situation. What's going on in your life? And then you help them just by asking questions. Like, are you just getting stuck in creating these hypotheticals in your head that aren't going to happen? Let's just focus on what are the facts on the ground?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that is, it's something that I'm helping someone do, but something that you don't need a therapist to do that. You just need to recognize that as a good, you know, coping mechanism or a good skill to practice of, okay, I often jump to the worst case scenario and I cause myself a lot of stress and anxiety hanging out there. So what else could I be saying about this situation? And sometimes people, you know, thumb type that onto their phone. Sometimes they write it down on a piece of paper in a journal or talk it through with a friend who can often help you say, well, okay, that's one possibility. What are the other possibilities? And just to sort of let it be a little bit more open until we find out what is actually going on.
You know, one thing you try to do, another tactic you use to help people when they get stuck in this, you know, catastrophic thinking, because that usually happens when we're in our default mode network, when it's kind of like more mind wandering. And that's why at night, that's where you usually feel like the most angsty and existentially angst is at nighttime. You're laying in bed and you're like, oh my gosh, what am I doing with my life? That even happens to me still, because you're in that default mode network. But one thing you try to do is you help people shift over to the task positive network, where it's basically your brain's, it's focused on something and you're not mind wandering.
Exactly. Well, that is, you know, so one thing you can be focused on in the task positive network or, okay, what are other possibilities? You're giving your brain a job, which is, let me think about something else other than the worst case scenario. Sometimes the task positive network can be distraction by focusing on something else. If, you know, I'm going to go run an errand, I'm going to watch something on Netflix, I'm going to call a friend on the phone. You just want to give your brain something else to do besides just going down the rabbit hole of the worst case scenario and hanging out in that default mode network. Your brain's default mode is to imagine the worst. And then, you know, even better is when the task positive network is focusing on, well, what else could be happening here? What are the facts? How can I problem solve? And so you give your brain something to do that's constructive rather than just imagining the worst.
Okay, so another skill people need to develop is how to feel. How do people mess up managing their emotions?
Yeah, so when we're feeling uncertain, not surprisingly, because we tend to think negatively, this happens in a nanosecond. We also feel negatively. So we feel anxious or stressed or overwhelmed or depressed. That's normal. I think oftentimes when young adults are struggling, they panic of I shouldn't feel this bad. Something is wrong. I need to, you know, like these sort of feelings shouldn't exist. And oftentimes you see that their parents panic of my kid's crying. This is terrible. Something bad's going to happen. And so, you know, just helping people understand that emotions are a part of life and, you know, so-called negative emotions, you know, aren't necessarily negative. They're sources of information. So they're telling us this is something you're worried about. This is something that's important to you, or this is something you're sad that you've lost in your life. And so helping people just accept even the negative emotions in their life as sources of information, not as something they need to panic about, actually, paradoxically helps emotions pass more quickly. So it's, you know, when we stop kind of wrestling with our negative emotions and say, okay, part of life, what is there for me to learn here? Those negative emotions tend to move on along. Whereas if we get into this fight with them where we panic and keep trying to get rid of them, they actually tend to hang around longer.
Yeah, you call this, you know, just kind of being comfortable with the negative emotions, paradoxical intervention.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Because it's, you know, when you say, I don't need to get rid of this feeling, it actually tends to pass more quickly. So you're sort of doing a, you know, mind trick on negative emotions, but it really is just about not being upset about being upset or anxious about being anxious or sad about being sad or stressed about being stressed, but just to say, okay, you are not going to get through your life and certainly not through your 20s without having these emotions. Quite often, that's normal. 20-somethings have more negative emotions than older adults. And so it's really about understanding, what are they trying to tell me? What am I worried about? Where do I need to gain competence? Or what am I sad about? What do I need to get more of into my life?
Yeah. And again, you're also trying to normalize these feelings. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, well, this is a diagnosis because I'm feeling anxious, depressed, whatever. It's like, well, no. Congratulations, you're a human being. You're feeling things that all human beings feel and have felt.
Well, right. And, you know, really everything that I do with 20-somethings, like you've said, it's adult development. It's relevant to us at all ages. I just am the kind of person that, you know, I try to get in there as early as possible in that trajectory. But if you think about going to the doctor for something, you know, in your 30s or 40s, and you're having a pain here or a, you know, flutter there, and the doctor says, oh, yeah, that's normal. It's this thing that happens when, you know, X, Y, Z, it doesn't mean anything or it'll pass. I mean, we forget how helpful that is, that is very helpful when someone says, oh, yeah, I know it hurts, but it's normal. Nothing to be worried about. That also has a function. My daughter actually had a sports injury a couple years ago, and it really persisted. So I took her to a specialist, and the guy said, oh, yeah, I've worked with big, tough ice hockey players, and this can hurt for months, but trust, it will get better. And I thought, great, that's all I needed to know. And I think we forget the value of telling someone, I believe that what you're experiencing is real. I know it hurts. I know it's difficult, but I have every confidence that things are going to get better.
You also talk about the skill of working. How can work help us become emotionally healthy?
Yeah, well, work actually is the number one driver of positive personality change in your 20s. And, you know, I think if we think about it any age, it's a pretty important source of confidence and competence. So, you know, it's probably what we spend more hours doing per week than anything else. So there are lots of opportunities to learn new skills and gain new competencies, become more confident, you know, everything from the concrete skills you need for work to the social skills of dealing with bosses or interns or coworkers. I mean, there's just so much growth happening on the job when you're in your 20s, or it should be. And if there isn't, you need to go find a job where you feel like you're going to have those growth opportunities. I know from the research, it's the number one leading source of stress and anxiety in the 20s, but it's also the number one source of growth and change. And those two things go together, obviously, because if you're going to be growing and changing, you're going to be putting yourself into situations that are new and uncomfortable and that you don't know how to do.
Yeah, I think all of us have this idea like, man, I wish I didn't have to work. But then when you look at the studies of people who, you know, get laid off from a job, they're unemployed for a while, and this happened in middle age, like depression just, it's off the chart. It's one of the most debilitating things that can happen to someone is when they're unemployed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of talk a couple of years ago about, you know, young adults are quiet quitting. And what did I think about that? And what I thought is I want to help them find jobs they don't want to quiet quit. Because, you know, maybe people imagine, oh, my life would be so great if I didn't work. But like you said, it actually usually isn't. People feel, you know, quite bored and understimulated. And so I think the idea is to find work that you feel good about. And, you know, now with hybrid possibilities, you know, I think that's more possible than ever that people can find work that really works for them.
Okay. So another skill that you think people need to develop is how to be social. And this is another thing we've been hearing a lot about that might be contributing to the mental health crisis in the United States is people are lonely, they're isolated. Why do you think we're having such a hard time making friends and socializing these days?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's a little bit like working from home. It has upsides and has downsides of that when people feel like they can sort of semi-scratch the itch of connecting with people over their phones or on their screens, then they're less likely to get out there and do that in person, even though we know that in-person interactions are different than interactions that we're having on screens. And so I think a lot of young adults, they move to new cities, they need to meet new people, and that's a different skill set than picking up your phone and texting someone or DMing someone on Instagram. You've got to sort of get out there and figure out, where are my people and how do I make conversations with them? But that, you know, most people don't realize this, but your 20s are actually the loneliest decade of life. We, you know, we imagine 20-somethings are, they're having so much fun, they have so many friends, they're just out and about all the time. It's really not true. You know, you're most likely in that age group to be, quote, between families. So, you know, you wake up in the morning alone in an apartment or in an apartment with people that you may not know well or may not get along with that great. And it's a lot of work to be constantly trying to find someone to go out with on Friday night or find somebody to go, you know, shopping with on a Saturday. So, you know, most young adults are actually quite lonely.
And I think part of the problem is when you're in high school, your friends are just pretty much given to you. Like you show up to school every day.
They're just right there.
And they're right there. And then when you're an adult on your own, it's up to you. Like you have to make it happen.
Right. And that's, you know, same for college. You have people in the hall, you have people in your classes, but then you may go to a workplace where there aren't that many young adults, or you may be working from home where you really aren't interacting with anyone. And so people have to sort of figure out, how do I meet people? You know, is it okay? What if it's through, you know, joining a gym? Well, that's one step, but then you have to figure out, how do I talk to people or say, hey, do you want to get coffee or let me give me my number? That there's a lot of steps in there and it requires, there's a lot of uncertainty involved in that and it requires a lot of courage.
So yeah, one of the things you do is you do social prescribing. So if you have patients that come in saying, oh, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling depressed, one thing you might turn to is like, hey, why don't you go out and try to make some friends? So like, what kind of things do you tell them to do, like, or recommend that they try doing?
Yeah, I mean, this probably just sounds so obvious or so basic to someone listening, but you would be surprised at how many people will say, I'm so lonely. And then you ask about their day and it's, you can easily see, you know, some relatively low hanging fruit of, well, why don't you try this? But I think I write in the book about a guy who came in my office who I really liked a lot. He was a great guy and he had a steady girlfriend, but she had moved states for like a job or something. And so ever since she left, I think she was sort of his leading form of social interaction, which often happens with young males. So she left and he was spending a lot of time on his phone. So I said, well, let's pull it up. Let's see how much on his screen time. I believe it was 10 hours a day because he was eating all of his meals in front of his phone. He was lying in bed on his phone. I mean, it was, that's where everything was happening. I said, well, what are you doing on your phone? And he said, oh, I like sports. I'm watching this game, those stats, whatever. And I said, well, what sports do you like to do? He said, I like to play basketball. So I said, okay, I prescribe your homework between now and the next time I see you is to get out and go play basketball with other people. And so it wasn't very long that he was doing that he said, yeah, I feel better now. I think I just needed to adjust better and differently to my girlfriend leaving and find healthier ways to get through my day. So it may seem pretty obvious and pretty basic, but you would be surprised how many people aren't sort of trying the solutions right in front of them.
And another thing you point out is that young people and even adults need to realize that making friends, it's going to take a long time. You cite research from Jeffrey Hall. We've had him on the podcast.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, he talks about it takes like about, you have to spend 50 hours with somebody to be considered as kind of a casual friend. And then right. It takes about 150 hours or more to, you know, make that person a best friend.
Right.
And when you're in high school and college, that was easy to do because you're probably, you know, you get those 50 hours in a few weeks. Right.
Right. You might get 5 hours a day with somebody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you're an adult, you might just get like an hour a week with somebody.
Right.
So it could take a year or two to make a really good friend. So you got to be patient.
Right. And people are often saying, how do I make friends? And, you know, the best way to make friends is to go out and live your life. I mean, outside of your house whenever possible, that you usually make friends over something, you know, so friends from grad school or friends from the playground when you had little kids or friends at your job or friends in the wine tasting class that you decided to take or in the running club. So rather than people imagining there's some separate program of things they need to do to make friends, the best way to make friends is to get out and do you, and you will meet people who are interested in the same things, have the same values, have the same interests. That's where friends come from. But to your point, it takes a while.
Yeah. And one of the side effects of getting out there and making friends is it can actually help you find love. You talk about a lot of young people you're seeing, they want to get married, but they can't find, they're having a hard time dating. Mm-hmm. But what the research shows, and people know this anecdotally, if you're hanging out with lots of different people, you're going to be put in the path of people who might be a potential partner for you.
Right. Friends are great practice for being partners. If you don't know how to be a good friend, I find it hard to imagine how you could possibly be a good partner.
Yeah.
So it's great practice because you start to think about, hey, it's not just about me. It's about, this is a two-way street here and I need to think about another person. Sometimes I need to resolve issues. So friends are great practice for being partners. And they're also a great way to meet partners that, you know, the more you're getting out and interacting with people. And again, I think I don't have anything against online dating. I've had plenty of clients meet people online, but it's a little bit to what I said about making friends is that, you know, rather than imagining there's like a separate program or a separate app or avenue for finding a partner, often get out and live your life, spend time with friends, and you're likely to meet people who are interested in the same life and the same future that you are.
Okay, so making friends can help you practice the skill of love, of romantic relationships. Related to this idea, in these chapters on the skills of love, and you also have the skill of sex, you devote a lot of time to an issue you've seen more and more in your patients in the past 15 years. And I think this is really relevant to men, porn use. Mm-hmm. How have you seen porn use change in your 20 plus years of working with young people?
Yeah, people always ask me, how are young adults of now different than when you started 25 years ago? I would say as human beings, they aren't very different. What's different is the technology available to them. And so that's created situations and problems maybe we didn't have 25 years ago. But a couple of decades ago, you know, everybody had seen porn, but it was harder to come by. You had to sort of have a Playboy or a Penthouse or see a movie on Cinemax. I mean, it just wasn't that available. So watching porn was not something that came up a lot in sessions on either side of the room. Now it's actually a routine intake or screening question that I have for all my clients. Young males are more likely than females to say, yes, I watch porn and probably too much. But I ask every client how much porn they're watching and whether that's working for them, not working for them, to kind of take a look at that. And what I've really learned from listening to my clients, especially to my young male clients, is that, you know, what kind of started as a curiosity or as entertainment kind of became more consuming and maybe even a compulsion, and that people spend a lot more time watching porn than maybe they really want to. And that it kind of has created for a lot of young men this anxiety about getting out and, you know, being intimate with someone in person, having sex with a real person, because, you know, watching porn doesn't necessarily translate to dating or to starting an intimate relationship with someone.
Yeah, you talk about some of the issues that they're seeing amongst young men who are habitual porn users, erectile dysfunction, performance mm-hmm. issues. And also a lot of the patients you talk to who have a porn addiction or just use porn too much, depression and anxiety. Like, mm-hmm. what do you think is going on there? Why is there a connection between depression, anxiety, and habitual porn use?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, to me, the biggest connection, because whether people can be addicted to porn or not is up right. for debate. But what I definitely see is that people will say, I'm watching porn every day and I don't want to be. So it makes me feel depressed about myself. You know, why am I doing this? What's wrong with me? Like, I feel weird walking around knowing that I'm doing this thing that I wish I wasn't doing. It makes me feel bad about myself that I'm, you know, kind of watching other people have sex rather than figuring out how to go out there and have it myself. And then there's the anxiety piece where, whether consciously or unconsciously, people imagine, well, I'm supposed to know how to do all that. I'm supposed to be able to perform like that. And the longer you spend, you know, kind of watching sex rather than trying to participate in having sex, the more likely you are to have that sort of stage fright or performance anxiety. So I'll have young male clients say, well, I just don't even know how to start. You know, what if I go out with someone and I can't perform? And I say, well, let's like take it back a few steps. What if you just, you know, go out with someone and get to know them, or go out with someone and make out and don't worry about sort of performing, not to mention, you know, performing like a porn star. Don't worry about that on the first date. Let's just spend some time with someone and see what happens.
Yeah. You talk about how porn use can get in the way of a healthy sexual relationship once that's, you know, part of your life with somebody. Is that you have these like weird expectations of what sex is supposed to be like because you're trying to mm-hmm. perform, right? You're trying to mimic what you're seeing there. And I've seen surveys with young people where it's a lot of young people who are doing things in the bed because they saw it on mm-hmm. you know, their TV screen or their computer screen, but they're actually not comfortable with it. But they think, right. well, this is what I'm supposed to do, is what I see. And you argue, instead of trying to like perform and trying to mimic what you see in these videos or whatever, sex and love should be like a jazz collaboration. You're working with the other person to figure out what works for you two.
Right. That it's, you know, don't try to imitate something you've seen other people do. Just be in the moment with the person you're with and figure out what that person wants to do and what you want to do. You know, the best metaphor or comparison I ever heard, I think I heard it on NPR, was someone, and I wish I could credit them because I don't remember who said it, but they said learning how to have sex from watching porn is like learning how to drive by watching Fast and Furious movies. That it's just not, it's not going to give you the best sort of scripts or, you know, playbook in terms of how most people actually want a sexual relationship to go.
Do you have any advice on, you know, say there's someone's listening, like I'm watching more porn than I want. Any advice on helping them stop?
Yeah. I mean, well, that's a spectrum. So, you know, I'm hearing more and more from men who are saying, I have a hardcore porn addiction. Like I'm in deep. And so I think if you're feeling that that's your situation, that I think people are treating that the way they treat other addictions. So look for addiction resources that specifically geared to this. But, you know, what is more common is young males, and I see this all the time, who are just saying, you know, I don't think I'm addicted to porn, but I'm really watching it too much. And so we come up with solutions together. You know, when you're leaning on a substance too much, no matter what it is, the first sort of line of defense is to figure out, well, how can we make this a little less available and how can we do something else? And so that may be, I don't bring my phone in the bedroom, or I got rid of my desktop. I mean, depends on, you know, where are you accessing this? When are you most likely to look at it? And can you kind of busy yourself at other times? And that may sound like not big interventions, but that's the great thing about working with young adults, is that these are when difficult habits tend to crop up, but they also haven't often been around all that long, in that they can be easy to shift. And so sometimes, you know, you make some lifestyle adjustments, and, you know, they're able to act on that pretty quickly. I have a client right now who came in a month ago and said he was getting high half the day, you know, noon to midnight. And I was like, well, that's probably a problem. So can we reduce that? And so he was, you know, has already been able to say, okay, I'm going to get my day done. I'm going to get my work done. And maybe I'll just be a nighttime smoker. And, you know, for now, that's where he is. Will he eventually become, actually, he said over the long haul, you know, 3 to 5 years from now, he would rather be a weekend smoker or a not at all smoker. And he's moving in that direction quite quickly and effectively without much intervention on my part, except saying, I think you can do this. Let's talk about how.
Two other skills that I was surprised to see pop up in the book was the skill to move, exercise, and the skill to cook. Mm-hmm. Why those skills? How do they help our mental health?
Well, I mean, I hope everybody's heard by now that exercise is always great for mental health, and there aren't any downsides. So unlike medications, which can be a mixed bag, getting out and moving more, it's good for our physical health, it's good for our mental health, it's, you know, can be good for our social lives, can be good for our work lives and creativity. There's really no downside to moving more. And about a third to a half of doctors will prescribe movement for mental health struggles, but that also means a half to two-thirds don't. And they should be, because oftentimes clients are coming in and they're saying, I want to feel better right now, immediately. And that makes people think, oh, well, maybe medication. But if you want to feel better right now, probably the quickest thing you could do to feel a little bit better is to move a little bit more. You don't have to exercise. You don't even have to play a sport. It's just whatever you're going to do and enjoy. So maybe you walk your dog more. Maybe you play frisbee. Maybe you play pickleball. Maybe you go for a hike. Maybe you do salsa dancing on the weekend. The best kind of, quote, exercise is whatever it is you're going to do.
Yeah, and we've had people on the podcast talk about that. Exercise as effective or even more effective than antidepressants without the downsides, without the side effects. Cooking. Why cooking?
Yeah, that might sound like a funny. Everybody's commented on that I've got cooking in my book. A couple of reasons I do. One is young adults, they just eat like crap, pardon my French. They really do not eat well. And so that's not helping, that we're learning more about how, you know, processed foods, junk foods are not great for your mental health, not great for your brain, that the gut is called the second brain because it's second only to the brain in terms of the number of neurons that it contains. So, you know, what you put in your body matters. There's also the issue of, I think, just, and, you know, people who cook are more likely to eat more healthily, but just knowing how to cook, I think, helps people feel more competent and more confident rather than, you know, feeling like they're running around trying to get some of their most basic needs met by another person or that they don't know how to do it. You know, knowing how to, you know, make a breakfast smoothie in the morning or pack a sandwich or make a meal at night really does help people feel like there's something that I can, you know, follow the instructions on and have a win on today. It also helps your social life because you're more likely to have people over or have a barbecue or a potluck. So again, no downsides to learning how to cook. And it can be incredibly grounding.
Okay. So another skill, last skill I want to talk about is the skill of how to decide. Your 20s are filled with lots of big, important decisions. How do 20-somethings, and maybe even people beyond 20-somethings, how do they get decision-making wrong?
Well, you know, your 20s are when you move from what are called small world problems to big world problems, because it's when you sort of move from school of there are right answers and, you know, clear ways to get an A or a B to life after school where there isn't a right answer to who should I partner with? What should I do? Should I take this job or that job? Where should I live? There aren't any right answers. There's no algorithm. There's no way you're going to be able to sort of game this or find out from another person what you should do. The good news is there aren't any wrong answers. It's really just what's right or wrong for you. And, you know, I think when we're looking for that answer, that's where the asking your therapist or asking your parents, what should I do? When really only you can decide. And, you know, I think that can be freeing when people recognize that there isn't a wrong choice to make here. There's only your choice. So you gather the best information that you can, and you make it based on like your own values and priorities.
Yeah. You talk about one problem that 20 somethings have is constantly looking for reassurance, and that can actually get in the way of making progress in life.
Yeah, actually, in the psychology world, they have seminars now about reassurance junkies, people who sort of always want to know, am I doing the right thing? Is this going to work out? Am I okay? And when you reassure people, it's actually a little bit like a drug, that you're giving them a hit of something that makes them feel better for about 5 minutes, and then they come back and they want more. So rather than reassure people, actually, recently, and I think I wrote about it in the book, but this happens to me all the time, I will say something that is meant to inspire confidence, and people will say, well, that's very reassuring. And I said, no, I'm not trying to reassure you. I'm trying to say, based on the evidence, I believe in you. You've gotten through this situation before. I think you can do it again. Recently, I was on a podcast and someone said, my life has been okay in my 20s, but what if it all goes sideways in my 30s? And I said, well, why would that happen? And, you know, we talked about how she had already made progress at work and was in a healthy relationship and had some nice friends. So she clearly had the skills to be off to a great start. So I really couldn't understand why everything would just, you know, go to pot in her 30s. And she said, oh, that's so reassuring. And I said, no, I'm not trying to reassure you. I'm trying to give you confidence that based on the data, on the evidence, there's no reason to believe your life is going to go sideways. And that's different from saying, oh, everything will be fine. But that's just sort of empty.
Well, Meg, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
Let's see. The book is sold everywhere, I hope. And on socials, I'm at Dr. Meg J. And then my website is megj.com.
Fantastic. Well, Meg J, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
You too, Brett. Always great to talk to you.
My guest today was Dr. Meg J. She's the author of the book, The 20-Something Treatment. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find more information about her work at her website, megj.com. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/megj, where you can find links to resources. We delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Make sure to check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles that we've written over the years about pretty much anything you think of. And while you're there, sign up for our email newsletter. It's completely free, and there's both a daily and weekly option. As always, thank you for the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you to not listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable, but the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
I got the charcoal mask! Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink?
This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera.
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.